fellow baseball nuts, and a big warm welcome before the sixth episode of the Johnny and Josh Show. Great pleasure to have your company. And though it's only two names in the title, there are four characters in the lineup. Great pleasure to welcome JC, the legend that is Eric, and big Davey Lengel back for hat-trick. There was me thinking Jeff Hurst was a legend, the only man to score a hat-trick in a World Cup final. Big Dave, you're on your own hat-trick, buddy.
I'll take it. Thank you very much, Johnny.
Thank you very much.
You say there are only four of us, but we also have Dave's mustache. So that's like the fifth supporting role. Yep.
That's a creation in its own right. Let's just do a very quick segue into a COVID update. More bad news, as though any of us are surprised. Your much loved and much maligned Mets, Big Dave, as if they haven't got enough problems.
They do. And isn't it just so typical that, you know, this comes right at the time where the lineup is finally starting to hit the way it was advertised. And right at the time they're set to play the Yankees, who, by the way, are totally banged up. So in theory, a Mets team that was on the up, that had won a couple of games against the highfalutin Miami Marlins, were ready to take on the Yankees, and now no series. So that's where we're used to that sort of disappointment around here, and that's fine. And hopefully they will be back on Monday. Rumors of a doubleheader, if they can actually get that in. So there is a chance.
Buddy, you say Monday, but I've read in a separate source they won't be playing till Wednesday. I don't know if you've heard anything. Have you, JC? Have you heard anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. And I thought we were getting to the end of the week and we're finally going to have a COVID-free week, and it just keeps on, the hits keep on coming. And you combine that with all the injuries that are happening in baseball, it's just been really wild. At the same time, we're finally getting to a point where we're seeing the wheat separated from the chaff a bit. So teams like the Miami Marlins, the Detroit Tigers, the Baltimore Orioles, who were all high flyers right at the start of this, are now starting to regress to the mean and get to the level that they're at. And we're starting to see teams like the Dodgers move to the top. But I think what's going to continue to sort of mix all this up is the injury element. And Dave, you mentioned it. I mean, the Yankees lose Gleyber Torres, you're losing James Paxton. You're just seeing so many injuries this year. It strikes me that it's a greater number than we've seen in the past.
And there's now talk as well of Australian baseball. They're moving their league to New Zealand. We all know what a great job Jacinda Ardern has done as Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Don't forget, Johnny, there were rumors of MLB moving to Japan, that crazy rumor. Remember that?
I do.
The big bubble in Japan.
And the Japanese would play during the night, but I don't think New Zealand's on the cards just yet.
New Zealand created a really nice facility for their team that they have in the ABL, so that makes it a little easier for them to make that transition from Australia proper over to New Zealand. But, you know, it's not Major League Baseball.
And that's the thing. A few weeks ago, New Zealand were able to have 55,000 people inside a stadium for a rugby match. But lately they've had a surge of cases, so they're trying to go into mini lockdown again. But a surge of cases in New Zealand is like 13. And for them, the 13 is not a bad going, but for New Zealand, they're trying to keep it clamped down. But whether the Aussies move their baseball or half their conference, apparently what it is, to New Zealand, that remains to be seen.
Let's hope that Major League Baseball doesn't get 13 more COVID cases for the rest of the season.
Yes, let's hope no one does. Let's hope no one does. That's a world we all want to live in. But let's focus on something positive, guys. Let's talk baseball.
Yes, before we talk baseball, let's continue talking about baseball, because we're going to do the leapfrog my in-game trivia, my Eric's Stumper, my trivia of the week.
As if I would ever do that, big guy.
For one shining moment, Eric, you're in the limelight.
So here's where I try to stump you guys once again. Now, hopefully we do actually see a 60-game schedule completed with this in this COVID era. But my question to you is, which player has had the most hits in the history of Major League Baseball within a 60-day period?
Ooh,
research has been done. Okay.
I'm sure.
In the history of baseball, which player has got the most base hits within a 60-game period? So is it A, Jose Altuve? Is it B, Ichiro? Or is it C, Johnny Damon?
I think that you need to make Ichiro an answer, like a multiple choice answer for every single question you use. He did it last week.
Is that a red herring or is it on purpose?
Do you know what amazes me about this, JC? You will remember when we went to Seattle on our road trip all those years ago, he wasn't the biggest fan of the Ichiro. Do you remember the Ichiro?
I like the Ichiro. Ichiro was one of the best.
Pretended to like it just because you wanted a freebie.
Probably the healthiest ballpark food I've ever had. Okay.
But the people at the stadium didn't like it as much. That was the story, right?
Yeah, now, can we stick with the question, please? Instead of sushi rolls?
Segway.
Let's close the limelight and move on.
No, hang on. So here we go. So notice that I didn't include Joe DiMaggio in that list.
Or as I said before, Ty Cobb.
Or Pete Rose.
Pete Rose.
Okay, the reason why in a 60-game period,
Chipper Jones, who
would have thought that a guy who hit 56-game hitting streak is not on the list?
I love Gouldie's just throwing in names. He doesn't know, Dave, why we were throwing in the other names who had long hitting.
Right. Okay, so moving on to the first segment, because basically Fernando Tatis has been tearing it up in Major League Baseball this week, hitting home runs left, right, and center. And he's been in the news this week for both good and bad reasons. And Johnny will take us through it.
Well, we're just going to focus on the bad because that's the story. And it's only bad if you have the perspective that it's bad. Because for my money, this man is the most enjoyable player to watch in the major leagues right now on his own. Absolute box office. And he's exactly the sort of player that's going to attract a young audience. But he's got himself into trouble because of breaking an unwritten rule. Rewind to Monday. The Padres were playing against the Texas Rangers. They are 10-3 up in the top of the eighth. And the pitcher on the mound, Juan Nicasio, has basically got the bases loaded with some pretty awful pitching around the ankles. And it's a 3-0 pitch. Now, you boys will know all about the, 30 unwritten rules, one of which is you don't swing on a 3-0 if up by six or more runs after the sixth inning. All of those conditions were met. Well, obviously, Fernando's not, perhaps up to date with these rules. He never looks down the third base line to his coach. He never gets a signal because he's just focused on doing his job. And Nicasio sends in a 92-mile-per-hour fastball. It wasn't even in the middle of the plate. It was going away. It was down on the outside edge. And Fernando does what he does. He made an amazing connection, amazing swing, and he put that baby into the stands for a four-run home run. He's going ballistic. He's enjoying himself. He's completely oblivious until such time you get the fantastic close-ups of the Rangers manager, Chris Woodward, who's giving him the devil's stare. And even his own manager, Jace Tingler, as he walks past, gives him a bit of a naughty thing to do. Needless to say, they react. The Rangers react. They throw a nasty 93-mile-per-hour fastball behind Mercado's back the next at-bat just to make it known that they're not happy. And I think it was – and this is really, really interesting. I think it was Homer that when the inning was over – mouthed off to the Rangers dugout and said, "We'll deal with it. We'll talk to him." This is Eric Hosmer. "We'll deal with it." And then he sits down with him and he has a chat with him. And I think this is the saddest thing of all for me. This kid who just does nothing but smile and play great baseball. And I think I'm right in saying he's still leading the home run count at the moment. I mean, he's having an amazing second season on the back of an amazing debut season. This kid is superstar status and he's the best thing in baseball, quite frankly. And he plays with a smile on his face. And at the end of the game, in a game where he has just hit two more home runs, and in that game, I believe he's tied Mike Trout for the leader the home run count, and he's sitting there looking miserable. And to me, it's madness. I understand the history of the game. I appreciate that there are certain unwritten rules, but this is one where I just can't get my head around it, and I don't understand why everybody's coming down on him. I think it was Chris Woodward who said, "I don't like it personally. It's kind of the way we were raised in the game." And yet in the same press conference, he then went on to say, "We don't quit. We fight." Well, hell, 10-3, guys. We've seen 10-3 ball games completely turned on their head, even if it is in the eighth. It happens. And my understanding in sport, you play hard and you play hard to the final whistle. And that's exactly what this young man is doing. And I didn't like what Jace Tingler did, who's worked his way up through the ranks to be the manager of the Padres. He basically threw Tatis under the bus. And I don't like that at all. That's not good management. That's my view. A very personal view. I'm not in favour of it. I understand unwritten rules. We'll talk more about those in a second, guys. But I thought this was a storm in a teacup, and I hated the way they made this kid feel. And he then goes out and apologises and says, probably next time, I'll take a pitch. And I hated that even more. What's your thoughts?
And with that, thanks everyone for being on the show today. It's been a great 2 hours and 32 minutes.
Wow. That's why I had to have a shower, because I got so heated about this one.
Johnny is so shy. That's what I love about it.
Gouldy, go on.
Yeah, I think let's simmer down for a moment. So first off, yours is the easy take. I think everyone agrees that the unwritten rules should be you know, consigned to the dustbin of history, that they're silly. And I think you have to understand this in two contexts. First, understand where these unwritten rules came from and understand the underlying factors for them. The unwritten rules themselves are silly, they're absurd, but they come from the idea that you should play with sportsmanship. It's just all been mutilated. So you should never show up a player. That I agree with. Never show up a player. If you're gonna flip a bat in a moment of exuberance, that's fine. That's 100% fine, because—
It wasn't always fine. Not until a few—
I agree. I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying what it should be. And this is what the problem is, which is that we're at a point now where these rules get so calcified that we don't think about the underlying reason, which is that we want to play with sportsmanship. Hitting a home run on a 3-0 count has nothing to do with sportsmanship. That's just playing hard. You should always play hard. And so let's try and remember why we were doing it and get rid of the rules, but just— we should still play with sportsmanship. As for the Jay Tingler issue, I disagree with you completely on that. Look, if your coach, your manager gives you the take sign on a 3-0 count, you follow the sign. It's not whether that's the right choice or not, but that's your manager, and that's part of the foundational element of the game. So, you know, whether you determine that and say it out loud, or whether you discuss
it internally. That's not the issue. Show me the proof that he did give him that sign, because at no stage did he even look down the third base line. So even if the sign was being given, he didn't see it because he wasn't looking that way. I've seen the footage, I've watched it in detail.
Often, Gouldy, you have a standing default 3-0 take on a team. And if you're going to wipe off the tape or give them the green light, you give a sign for that. So that you don't necessarily need to look at the third base coach to know that, if that's sort of the standard for your team.
Keith Hernandez had an interesting take on it also. Keith Hernandez felt, who is the, for those who don't know, the borderline Hall of Fame broadcaster for the New York Mets, who played with the Cardinals and the Mets and finally with the Indians, and is very outspoken and extremely colorful. He found Tatis to be selfish in that instance, because knowing that these sort of self-policing rules exist, that he was putting his teammate in danger. And in fact, we saw the next guy come up and get a pitch thrown right behind him, and he found it so... to be kind of selfish in that way. I don't think for a minute that Tatis would have, you know, been thinking about that. You know, if I try to hit a home run, the next guy up is going to get buzzed. But it was an interesting take. And of course, Ron Darling, his partner, who also pitched for the Mets, completely pulled him apart. He said, the game isn't played like that anymore. And we know that comebacks exist, and it's just not really in the DNA to have that kind of thought.
Keep in mind, 3-0 count, he hits an oppo field home run. I'm sorry, you could give me a 3-0 count and throw me a cookie down the middle of the plate at the major league level. I'm not hitting an oppo home run one out of a 5 million times. So, you know, it takes a certain skill level. I think the bottom line is, let's bend these unwritten rules and play by one rule, which is just play with respect for the other team. Don't try and show them up. If you get caught up in the moment and you flip a bat, that's fine. But beyond that, beyond that, you play to win.
I'm totally with you about respect. And it was really interesting, because obviously my knowledge of the game, my history of the game, is nothing compared to you boys. So I went and printed off the unwritten rules, of which apparently there's about 30, but I was looking at some of them.
Where did you find unwritten rules, Gouldy? You're very correct.
They're not
supposed to be written.
There's an actual... very good. No, but I'll tell you what was really interesting about it was trying to understand why. Now, why would this one in particular be an unwritten rule? And I did watch something that was on Facebook, actually, that was, I thought, nailed it and totally summed up how I felt about it. I think it's from an output called John Boy Media. And the guy's reference, which really made me laugh, and this is his quote, is basically, because pitchers historically are huge babies and they masquerade that with toxic masculinity. Now, obviously, you boys would know all about that. That's not something I can relate to, but I love that as an explanation. It's all about, you know, protecting a pitcher. This kid, that got hit. I mean, if you watch that at bat, I mean, it was, you know, his pitching was pretty diabolical. Don't load the bases in the first place if you don't want somebody to hit a grand slam, and then don't run up another three balls, you know, to put the bloke in a 3-0 in the first.
I mean, this guy in question.
Do you know what his stats are for the season? He's got an ERA of 40.5. Focus on your pitching, son. Don't focus on trying to exude the blame elsewhere.
The line, Gouldy, is, say someone, a pitcher, throwing a perfect game, do you bunt? And I say yes. So you're late in the game, do you bunt for base hit? And I say yes, again, because you're playing to win. It's not trying to show up the other team. You're not trying to disrespect them. And as long as you play with respect for your opponents, anything should be on the table.
At the end of the day, you set your field accordingly, knowing that there's a possibility they're looking to bunt. If the guy's pitching that well and it's a no-hitter, what else are you going to do to get on base? Your job is to get on base to win a ball game.
No other written rules.
It's fine.
Can I just close this out?
No, I'll be closing it. Nobody wants to make it quick.
Gotta go, Gouldy.
I'm sorry, guys. I love you to hear this one.
Go on,
this
make
is
it quick.
On the list of unwritten rules, and I love this. Do not assist a member of the opposing team. That's an unwritten rule of baseball.
That's an unwritten
okay.
rule?
From unwritten rules to actual rules, we're now talking about, the dreaded shift. But is it dreaded? And what is the shift? Josh Chetwin will take us through it.
Well, defensive alignments have changed a lot over the past decade, and there were instances going back into the 70s where every once in a while you might move an infielder to the outfield or vice versa and change your alignment. But today it has become such a central part of the game. When the Detroit Tigers were doing so well in their first 10 games, they had a whopping 65.3% of the times in which they put a shift on. And the number was over 80% when they were facing a certain type of batter, left-handed hitters. So we're seeing it, and as a result, we're seeing just plays that we would have never, ever expected to view before because of this. And a great example occurred this week when Manny Machado on Tuesday was playing because of a shift. He was third baseman, but was playing behind second base. A fly ball's hit to deep right field. Machado is able to lope all the way out, almost to the warning track, and catch a ball over his shoulder. This is the third baseman catching a ball in deep right field. And I guess the question is for all of us whether this is a good thing or a bad thing for baseball. And Dave, I know you have an opinion.
I don't like it. For me, it's kind of like, you know, what are you going to start putting linemen in the secondary? I see a shift, a crazy shift. I'm throwing the flag 15 yards, illegal formation. I mean, you know, poor Joey Gallo was talking about it this week. He said, you know, we grew up trying to hit the ball up the middle, and now we hit the ball hard up the middle every time it's an out. It was pretty sad to watch, actually. He was lamenting all the righties who can hit hard line drive screamers to left field and have a blast, while every time he hits the ball to right, he's hitting it into like, you know, there's 17 people over there ready to catch anything he puts there. So, you know, I just feel like we have positions. It's part of the tradition of the game. Tradition of the game in that sense, I think, is important. If you go to there's nothing that says, you know, you have to have a turkey at Thanksgiving. But if there's no turkey, you're going to get upset. It's tradition. Let's have nine players where they belong, and let's play baseball. And instead of this, like, you know, Bill Belichick stuff.
All right, Grandma. All right. Simmer down. No, I have to disagree. I cannot disagree with you more on this because of all the reasons we're talking about. Baseball is a game of adjustments. When you're up to bat and you're a pitcher and you face a batter for the second time, you throw different pitches. You try and do things differently in order to upset the rhythm of the hitter if you're a pitcher. Or as a hitter, you try and read what the pitcher's doing. And that battle is at the heart of what makes baseball so great. So why not move around players in order to make an adjustment and to better utilize the players that you have on the field? It's just part of the game. And I get, like, to me, singles are sexy. I'm like the one person who thinks that's probably because I can
singles
never.
Those are very sexy.
Like a great
more
line
balls,
drive.
More balls in the air now, Josh.
I know. You know, now we're all thinking launch angle because we have to avoid the shift. But that's part of the game, and you got to figure it out. Learn how to hit the other way. Joey Gallo, of all people, a dead pull hitter, learn how to hit to all fields. That's a more complete player to me. So I think that it's an okay thing.
Let's just get down to brass tacks, because baseball is a game that has issues. Is the game better with or without the shift? Because leagues make rule changes to improve the sport. Does the shift improve the sport, or does it make it a less palatable sport?
Definitely improves the sport.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Dave, which is that, like, from a viewership standpoint, point, when you have these strange shifts, you start not maybe, especially if you're a traditionalist, enjoying it as much. But to me, I agree with Gouldie, and I'll leave it to him because he hasn't had an opportunity to weigh in on this. But to me, the idea that you are trying to be smart, you're trying to outsmart the team, that's part of the strategy of the game. And I think that it's something that's worthwhile. Gouldie, go.
Well, you know, does it improve the game? Well, it certainly does with the example that you've referenced, Manny Machado. You know, great players make great plays, and that was a great play, and it's great to see he's a great athlete.
But how do you score it?
Is the scoring? Well, you come up, you can work that one out.
That's not an issue.
Absolutely. Big Dave, let me give you an example. If you were to take in another sport your attitude to its logical extreme, then I played inside forward when I was a kid playing football because we had five at the front, two wingers, two inside forwards, and a centre forward. We then had a mid half and left half, right half. I talk to my son about these positions. He's got no idea. Why? Because the whole 5-3-2 concept formation, it's yesterday's news. Football's gone on. It's a much better sport for it. It's proving to be dynamic. All sports should be dynamic. It should be constantly looking to change and to improve and to make it a better viewer spectacle. At the end of the day, it's about the joy of being a sports fan. And if that improves the game, 100% I'm for it. And I cannot believe that sticking to tradition and not looking to enhance the quality of the game, that you would ever think that actually is beneficial long term. You want to get a young audience? Baseball is an old audience. We need youngsters. This is the sort of thing. Let's go back to Tatis. He's the sort of player that's going to get the kids in. He's got the dreadlocks. He's a superstar. He's a phenomenal hitter. And he plays with joy in his heart. Don't destroy the joy, Big Dave.
So Gouldie, should we get rid of county cricket for 2020?
That was just going to say, does cricket have the shift? I was just going to ask that.
No, but cricket's got T20. Cricket's now got the 100. They're trying different things. They're trying to find other solutions.
But that's a different game, though, to some extent, right? You're playing a different code of...
That's like a seven-inning doubleheader.
This is trying to get you the best of both worlds, which is to continue. I agree with you. Don't get me wrong. I agree with you, but I understand what Dave's saying, especially for baseball, where tradition is so intertwined in the love of the sport.
But if you talk about cricket, you're still playing five-day tests.
No cricket chatter, even though I like cricket. Don't worry. Now here, yes, but I'm with David here because come on, if you are one of those people at a game who is filling out a scorecard, and your third baseman gets the out by the right field foul pole, come on.
Eric, you
sound like a bureaucrat, Eric. It's like you didn't stamp the docket
like
correctly.
Khrushchev with banging the shoe in the UN kind of thing. Yeah, yes.
Seriously.
All right. Moving on, because another thing that happened this week, which is unfortunate, actually, was a bit of a hot mic moment for a certain commentator, which David Langell, our very own esteemed journalist here, one of the many that are here on this podcast, wrote about in The Guardian this week. And Dave, take us through it.
Well, obviously, we're not going to repeat what he said on this podcast, but he did make a homophobic slur when he didn't believe he was on the air. And I think the thing that struck me the most about it is just the sort of brazen sense of entitlement and the fact that that he felt comfortable enough in his work environment to say those things because, you know, we don't hear it. We're not supposed to hear it, but there's other people on, if you're familiar with the television setup, there's people in the gallery, in the master control room, in the trucks, there's people on the floor. There's any number of people who have access to that feed at all times. And the fact that he felt comfortable enough to say it, and even in the way that he said it and the tone and the kind of strength and the comfort of which he said it, struck me as particularly brazen and kind of, you know, in a word, disgusting. We don't know whether or not the crew would sort of aid and embed that behavior, if it was a sort of chummy, you know, boys club in which that sort of thing would be accepted and okay, or if perhaps, you know, Brenneman was, and I don't know Brenneman, but if you know, it's not uncommon in television to see overwhelming personalities on sets and in booths in which you just have to sort of put up with behavior that is unacceptable. We've heard some of that in the case of Ellen DeGeneres, the US-based celebrity talk show host, where people in the crew have been coming out with these stories about how they've been treated so badly and they couldn't really talk, and it took kind of people speaking in the shadows to get these stories out. But there's just a sense of entitlement there that shouldn't be taking place, in addition to the fact that what he said was just morally corrupt and, you know, completely unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, David, it's abhorrent. It's the wrong thing to do. And there's no excuse for it. At the same time, I'm not a huge fan of the cancel culture, and I do believe we need to give some room for people to make amends when they do things that are wrong. I think what really took me back was when he tried to apologize. He's in the middle of what's meant to be a heartfelt apology and then starts going back to the play-by-play and then comes back to it, which completely undermined anything that he was trying to do. And to me, the comment was abhorrent and there's no excuse for it, but to not be able to apologize in a way that feels sincere really adds on to the issue.
And Josh, do you know there was a second apology? So he had a night to sleep on it and he wrote a second apology in print during basically which he denied knowing that that word, you know, had a tradition of violence and, you know, was discriminatory. And if that, I mean, this is after having, you know, 16 to 18 hours to sort of think this through and still write down denying that tells you everything you need to know about what's going on there.
It's brutal, but it's also a reminder just how much these broadcasters, we allow them into our homes in a way, and you see them almost as part of your family if you're a big baseball fan, that you hear this voice, it becomes a comforting element, and you have certain expectations as a result because of the role they play. If you're a fan, particularly in baseball, where you have these long periods and some downtime where they're expected to show a little personality and sort of talk about things beyond it, and when you get let down by those broadcasters who have been in your life since you were a child, it's particularly heartbreaking.
Will he be back?
Well, that's the thing. He's been reaching out to the gay community as well, and sort of like talking about his gaffe that he did on air. Is it enough? I'm not sure because he needs to apologize a bit better than what he has been.
Marv Albert bit a woman and came back.
That was a different era. Yeah. It was before. I'm not a huge fan of the cancel culture, but he needs to do so much more to deal with this. And, you know, the suggestion right now seems to be that he doesn't understand what he's doing. You need to really take the time to understand how wrong what he did is.
And I can't agree more. I've kept quiet on this because obviously I'm the old man of this group, so I'm sort of more from his generation. And, you know, and unfortunately my generation did talk about things without really thinking through the hurt and damage it might cause. And I'm with you that I totally am against this cancel culture, particularly with examples that we've seen elsewhere across that, you know, gets to the point of being ridiculous, you know, when people have spent a lifetime building up a career. But the apology has to be sincere. And I agree with you that, you know, he has to be proactive. And I mean, I read an article that was very much from the LGBT community saying, you know, that there is a way back for him, but they were, you know, they were talking about what he's got to do and how he's got to do it. So it really depends on his sincerity. And I hope that if he is sincere, that he can be given a second chance. He can be forgiven because it's a live broadcast. It's not a live broadcast, you know, mic on, mic off. At the end of the day, everyone at some stage has said something stupid in their life, which they regret and wouldn't want to be defined by.
And it comes back to trust, right? Is that we need to be able to trust him again. And we talk about the relationship between the commentator, especially hometown commentators and their fans.
And don't forget, we're talking about, he goes well beyond Cincinnati. This is the MLB's number two Fox voice. And also does NFL games for Fox. So while he doesn't have the kind of, you know, the portfolio of like a Mike Breen or like a Marv Albert or a Costas or any number of the, or Joe Buck for that matter, this is a big voice in and around North American sports. And, you know, there will be a void there.
And his dad, I mean, there's a legacy here, isn't it? His dad is a legendary Cincinnati.
He comes from a broadcasting stock, indeed. Now, moving on, because if you want to hear more or read more about that story, you can go online and read David Langell's article in The Guardian.
Here, here. We'll put that on our social media.
Moving on a lighter note or a light beer note, or less filling. Tastes great.
Single
calorie.
COVID, of course, has affected many lives and affected a baseball schedule and affected many other sports, but it's also affected people going to baseball bars or baseball watering holes, saloons. Baseball is part of the culture of beer. Even if you're a teetotaler, beer is synonymous with, you know, with baseball and going to a game or going to a sports bar. But Josh will tell us more.
Yeah, two big losses since the COVID epidemic. We've had real meaningful losses, of course, but this for baseball fans were a bit heartbreaking. In May, Foley's, which was a very famous Yankees bar, closed. This was a place where David Cone and Brian Cashman would tend bar during charity events. David Wright, the great Met, had his first meal as a big leaguer there and made sure that Foley's was his final stop on the night he retired. That place closed, had amazing, amazing memorabilia. And now this week, so that was in May, now this week, McGreevy's has closed. Now, it was named after Michael Nuff Said McGreevy, was a very famous saloon owner back at the start of the 20th century. And this particular bar, which was in the Back Bay in Boston, was owned by the Dropkick Murphys frontman, Ken Casey. The Dropkick Murphys are almost considered the house band for the Boston Red Sox. And they closed their doors too. And it sort of made us think a lot about the connection of beer and baseball. When you think back to all the owners who really got their start, probably to me, the most famous is the Bush family. Of course, they own the St. Louis Cardinals. The Milwaukee Brewers, even though they're not owned by a brewery, are a big one as well too. But they're not alone. I think Jacob Rupert was you know, the Yankees' longtime owner from 1915 to 1939, and he made his money in the beer trade. And the connection, Miller Field, which actually is going to change its name next year, but is named after beer. So the connection is so tight. So it's very sad to see these two particular saloons close their doors for good.
I've been in those places, and although I was never really into the Midtown bar scene, they are huge losses. I remember during the Subway series being in there, and the place was just, you know, like a total zoo. We went down in there to cover it for the BBC, and it was the energy in there was extraordinary. And New York has lost a lot of places like that, and this is, you know, unfortunately part of the way it's going. But, you know, baseball and beer, the sad thing about me is that I think I could count on one hand how many beers I've had at a baseball game, because I'm usually either driving or cycling or a member of the press. So, like, you can't go wearing a press badge and start swilling down beer, even though you want to.
Didn't stop Eric.
You guys are in the minority, because I found a statistic that said that 81% of regular drinkers, which I think we would all fall in that category, have a beer when they go to the baseball game. So obviously we've had extenuating circumstances. My favorite beer baseball story ever, though, was 10-cent beer night in 1974 when the Rangers played the Indians. And normally a beer would cost 65 cents. The great quote was from Tim Russert, who was the longtime moderator of a big political show here in the United States called Meet the Press, and who was actually at that game. He said, "I went with $2 in my pocket, you do the math." And what ended up happening was it got so drunk that a riot ensued, and the game had to be canceled when the score was 5-5.
You know what's even more amazing about that, Josh?
Yeah.
They brought it back.
Yes. Yes.
And they have people on the field. They have right. They have all this stuff, and then they bring it back, and apparently it goes off without a hitch.
Well, because there was a two-beer. There was a two-beer maximum.
That explains.
So they put a bar on it. But I love it. I brought $2. You do the math.
That's an all-time quote.
Now, you know, guys, I could listen forever to these stories of these great bars, because if you remember, we had the sports bar in the Haymarket in London, which no longer exists. I used to love going there. The only place you could guarantee to watch baseball late at night. That was such a buzz. I so wish we had that tradition over here. There's not enough sports bars in this part of the world. And you're talking about Foley, that obviously launched this story. I was just looking into this as well. And you mentioned the memorabilia, JC. 3,500 baseball, pucks, jerseys, you name it. And this is the best bit of memorabilia. They've got the diagram of Alex Rodriguez's hip surgery drawn by the surgeon at the bar.
Wow,
the man who carried out the surgery, and that was part of the memorabilia. You can't buy that, can you?
It was also New York history. So their urinals, which is always a big part of any pub, were from the old Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which was a famous hotel that was torn down when the Empire State Building was built. So, I mean, it span New York history as well. But that makes sense, right? Because most baseball bars are not just representative of their team, they're representative of their city.
Absolutely.
I have. I'm proud to say I have urinated in those. urinated or urinal.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Wait, is the sports cafe in London still going, Johnny?
No, buddy.
No, that's how I go.
Very sadly. Very sadly. Now, that's a great night there.
I'm with David here with this one because I'm not much of a beer drinker at the stadium because A, the beer is always overpriced. B, you don't want to go to the bathroom level five times during the game kind of thing. And C, I prefer doing my drinking
with your prostate.
Not that old yet. but also, you know, I prefer drinking in sports bars and watching games and spending my money there. And with easier access to urinals that come from classic hotels.
Did you guys ever see the movie Goodwill Hunting? There's a great beer bar story in that where he had a ticket to go to the 75 World Series where Carlton Fisk, he being Robin Williams' character, he talks about seeing his wife and choosing to go and watch the game in a bar rather than be at the game so he could spend time with his future wife. Great movie.
Great movie. Go. Matt Damon loved it. Now, I jinxed the Yankees in 2004 in that sports bar in the Haymarket. The Yankees.
Story
that?
For another day, Golden.
Another day. Yes, one day we'll, because it's a family show, we'll tell you about the urinal encounter between Johnny Gould, myself, and Rudolph Giuliani.
I know that story.
It's a great story. We'll tell you another day. Yeah. one more thing. Also, it's affected the sports bars here as well. There's the home plate, the home run bar in Westfield Mall next to the London Stadium, which opened up this year in anticipation of the upcoming, well, the non-upcoming Cardinals Cubs game, which would have happened already, and they open up prior to the games, and they have batting cages in there, they have a bar, they have like a Philly cheesesteaks there. At the last time I checked, they're closed. They're hoping to reopen, but it's a tough sell now. They might be another victim of COVID. Now, moving on, because it is the seventh inning stretch time. And let's see. Let's look at those pecs. Look at those old men pecs.
Double gun show.
Firepower.
They got some pythons.
We're moving on to the baseball book of the week. Now, we were talking about unwritten rules of baseball. And if you want to find a good book on the unwritten rules of baseball, I recommend The Unwritten Rules of Baseball. By Paul Dixon.
It's a little on the nose, isn't it?
Is that our second Paul Dixon book?
It is actually.
Paul Dixon gets two books. Josh Chetwynd doesn't get any.
He gets shut out. Gets the goose egg. I know. Yet again.
There's anyways. They're the unwritten rules of baseball.
Anyway.
because there is this one from I think anonymous. I don't know.
You gotta say what you're picking up for this.
That's true, and I don't know. I can't read it.
It's Baseball in Europe by Josh Chetwynd.
Is it anonymous? I guess so. It's
Josh. You're hitting the Mendoza line behind or below the Mendoza line. That's how bad you are.
I'm over.
The unwritten rules of baseball by Paul Dixon. Still relevant today. Still relevant to what we were talking about earlier. That's my book recommendation of the week, amongst many other ones written by people other than the last name beginning with C. Now, moving on to the baseball movies. Oh, yes, we love our baseball movies. And, you know, we try not to pick the obvious ones, even though we have a few in the past. But here's one that's not so obvious over here in the UK. And I'm talking, of course, about the Bad News Bears. The original Bad News Bears with Walter Matthau.
Definitely the original.
O'Neill.
A lot of beer in that film.
It's a classic. Tane O'Neill, Walter Matthau, about the drunken manager taking up this little league team. And there were two sequels about it as well, actually. And for people of our age, I guess, we grew up fondly with this. And I will be – there were two add-ons here.
Yeah. I would say Bad News Bears is one of my top three baseball favorite movies of all time because it's about baseball, but it's about relationships. It's just a fantastic film. And the second one, Bad News Bears Break Training, is for a certain generation the dream movie. It's like every little kid's dream. The kids all get into a van with no adult supervision, drive to Houston and play in the Astrodome, and they're great moments of cameos from Cesar Cedeno and Bob Watson. Yeah. It is the ultimate guilty pleasure. That movie, I recommend it if you just particularly if you're young and you're like, oh, you know, baseball is my dream. The third one, one of the worst movies ever made about baseball.
So now the third one in the trilogy of the original Bad News Bears was the Bad News Bears go to Japan. And here's...
No.
It really should have gone home and retired.
Yeah. It's a guilty pleasure for me, that
That's
one.
It's like Back also, to the Future 3. Oh,
how can you slag off Tony Curtis movie? The man was a legend.
That was Tony Curtis after he jumped the shark. I mean, he was done.
Bad News Bears go to Japan. Here's one from young Eric Jansen when he was very young. I actually read the book, Bad News Bears go to Japan. It was actually
the novelization?
I remember going the novelization of the movie. I remember going to well, my mom and say, Mom, can I have this book? She goes, all right. And I actually read Bad News Bears go
Eric,
to Japan.
Did you have any friends when you were young?
I can't believe
this. This is back when children used to read books. All right, so it's like, and so yes, I read. Yeah. I read
War and Peace, Tale of Two Cities, novelization of Bad News Bears go to Japan.
Bad News Bears. What I love about Bad News Bears is talk about things that will never, ever, ever happen. Now, which is a drunk coach,
or anything that comes out of the character Tanner Boyle's mouth in that.
Now,
including this, I want to give you the quote. Now get back to the stands before I shave off half your mustache and shove it up your left nostril. That's the classic right there.
At least it said nostril.
That's the only family-friendly line. There are some you have kids saying things that are pretty unspeakable nowadays. But
there was a reboot, might I add, made in 2005 with Billy Bob Thornton. I wouldn't recommend it. Some people said it was
hard all right.
I remember being at the 2005 All-Star Game in Detroit, and Billy Bob Thornton was there plugging the film. No one went to see it. Really, but
I wouldn't touch that with two masks and a visor. That's the COVID equivalent.
One of the great things in the original is that when we were kids, you had to have your team sponsored by a local business. It was sort of part of the civic involvement of Little League. And so, you know, the best team in that league is Denny's, you know, the popular food joint. And the Bad News Bears are sponsored by Chico's Bail Bonds. So, you know,
I love it.
Get out of jail and go see the Little League team.
Guys, we still haven't mentioned Tatum O'Neal, who I absolutely loved. What a great little actress she was. Fantastic.
All right.
1976. I was 15 years old, boys. I had a big crush. Do you also know, bit of trivia for the original, the score was by Jerry Fielding, and it was an adaptation of the principal themes of Bizet's opera Carmen. How about that? A little bit of classic.
I'll give you one more trivia. The Little League it was based on was the Little League I grew up playing in, West LA Little League. The author played in on a Little League.
You look a bit like Tatum O'Neal.
Yeah. And you have a crush on me, just like you did with Tatum O'Neal. So
Oh, my Lord.
Can we move on?
We're moving on again now.
I'm sure the authorities will be very interested to listen to this podcast.
From the medium of cinema, we move to the medium of the small screen. No, not the small screen that we're doing it on the internet or anything like that. We're talking about television. Remember that when kids still used to watch television, when we used to watch television, forget TV licenses. I'm talking about of one classic sitcom that still stands today is, of course,
Leave It to Beaver.
Cheers!
The greatest
knows
TV
your name.
Comedy ever.
A great bar and baseball connection.
There we go. Since we're talking
Sam
about
Malone.
Beers and just Sam Malone, of course. You know, you don't have to be a beer drinker. You could be a teetotaler like Sam Malone was in Cheers. He had to quit drinking because Mayday Malone was the main character in the TV show Cheers, who was a Red Sox pitcher. And by the way, did you know that Sam Malone actually has stats in baseballreference.com?
Does he?
You know that Sam Malone was actually 16-30 with a career ERA of 4.01?
Is that right?
He pitched for the Boston Red Sox between 1972.
How many saves?
You know what? They don't say. Ooh. They don't say because Mayday Malone, who, of course, he was when the bases were loaded, so was he.
I can't find that. That's not in there.
Sam Malone, racehorse.com. He has a career of ERA of 4.01 and.
I'm not seeing that.
Are you Googling live on air now?
I'm Googling. I want to see that. Mayday Malone.
Refute my stats of Sam Mayday Malone. So don't forget, he pitched the Red Sox from 1972 to 1978, allegedly, which means he would have been on the same bullpen with Bill Lee.
If you do go on the internet, there are great Photoshop examples of Sam Malone. There's a 1976 Topps baseball card of him that's been made. And I love that I've seen a picture of him with Carl Yastrzemski, with Yaz, that's just so well done that I love it. So, you know, it's like he's been pushed into the real world, Sam Malone.
In the entire series of Cheers, there was only one Boston Red Sox player that actually made a cameo on the show. Do you know which one that was?
Wade Boggs.
Wade Boggs.
Yeah. He's the only Red Sox who actually appeared on the show.
So I got my trivia out of the way. I don't need to answer Eric Snupper because I answered that one.
There we go. Now, moving on. That's it for the seventh inning stretch. So now we move on to the trivia question and answer. Now, just to reiterate what I asked these gentlemen here earlier in the show was that in a 60-game period, which player has a record for most base hits? Right? So now, since we're hopefully going to see a 60-game schedule here in this season, I don't think any of these records will be broken. But going back to the whole asterisks thing, so who hit the most base hits in the 60 games? Was it A, Jose Altuve, B, Ichiro, or C, Johnny Damon?
I'm going with Jose Altuve. He's still on.
Okay, interesting. David?
I'll go with the outlier. Well, why not? Go with Damon.
Johnny Damon.
Yeah, I'd probably go with that.
Judas.
I'd probably go with Altuve too.
Okay, so it goes in this order, actually. Altuve, last season in the 60.
Oh, we're last, period, Goldie.
He hit 103 base hits. Okay.
Wow.
Johnny Damon.
Scorching.
In a 60-game period, hit 111.
It's Ichiro.
Ichiro in 2004 in the 60-game period hit 120.
Wow. Three guesses and we got it wrong.
Exactly. Three so-called experts.
And then you guys, the lowest hanging fruit possible. Nobody wanted it.
Now, ironically, now the
psychological warfare from Eric.
Now the thing is, Joe DiMaggio, who had a 56-game hitting streak, you think would have been in that category. He only hit 91 in that total in that 56-game hitting streak.
All right, Eric.
95 after 60.
I've got a stumper for you, okay? Because you always make us feel small. It's time to repay the favor.
As long as
it has to do with your beloved Canada. Who was the hitter to get the first ever major league hit in a game in Canada in a major league regular season game?
I almost said Babe Ruth, his first career professional.
No, major league.
Yeah, major league. I feel like saying Willie Upshaw or something, but
Willie Upshaw with Toronto.
Too late.
He wasn't playing in Jerry Park.
Oh no! Sorry. Oh my God, Jesus!
Come on, Eric.
Joel Buckabella. Right.
Ah, Buckabella is a good one.
Kurt Flood.
Just for fun.
Kurt Flood, of course. You know, I should have known that. Oh my God, I am.
There you go. So, Eric, how does it feel?
Hey, congratulations, guys. Now the whole of the UK knows that we know nothing about baseball. This is fantastic.
By the way, when I'm going to redeem myself with some interesting knowledge. Out of those 56-game hitting streak that Joe DiMaggio had, no, one of them was a bunt. He was proud of that, by the way.
I've got to add one. I know we're pressed for time, but I've just got to add that this is a Johnny Damon story. I walked into the visitors clubhouse at Fenway Park, and the Indians were in town. And I walk in, and the Indians are watching Major League on television before the game.
Johnny Damon
comes in and starts talking about how the first game he ever went to was in Municipal Stadium, and that he like broke into the stadium or something like that. I don't know if he was telling the truth or not, but the Indians watching Major League. So then, of course, I went
that's
around
meta.
Asking them who was who, like who was Behringer and all that stuff, and we had a great time. They loved the film, by the way. They loved it.
That you can't write that. Great stuff.
Great story.
All right, moving on. Now, one more final thing about Joe DiMaggio. If he would have hit 57 games in a row, Heinz 57, the very good steak sauce, by the way, would have given $10,000 just a sponsor for one day, Heinz 57, if he went to 57 games.
That was a lot of money back then.
It was a lot of money back then. Moving on to Johnny and the mailbag.
Thank you, Eric. We have obviously already proved that we don't know anything, so this may prove a little tough. We've had many a question. I'll get as many as I can in. So thank you to everybody getting in touch on the Facebook, the Johnny and Josh Show, Twitter and Instagram at Johnny and Josh. I'm going to venture first on Twitter. I've had a great chat with the Indians UK and a great question asked, which was about James Stephen
Karinchak. And obviously you boys will know exactly who I'm referring to. And the big question is, you know, how do you take a young arm that's this good? And I was looking at this kid. I mean, he's only been around, obviously, two, three years since he's been in the minors up to the majors. And he looks pretty awesome. And yet they're using him in a relief pitching capacity. So the question that was being asked that's been sought, explanation, JC, what happens in the minds of the great baseball coaches when they look at a kid like this with an amazing arm and they go, you're a relief pitcher, you're a starting pitcher? How do you make that call?
I mean, there are two elements to that discussion. One is that it's not uncommon for a pitcher who ultimately have a major league career as a starter to start in the bullpen. You're able to control the innings a little better and how much they pitch. So it doesn't necessarily mean that will always be the case. And then the other reason is that if you are particularly adept at one or two pitches, as a starter, you're going to need to have a repertoire of four pitches at least, because you're going to have so many different matchups and you're going to face batters on multiple occasions. So you need to have a broader repertoire. But if you are particularly adept at maybe, you know, a cutter and one other pitch, or just a cutter if you're Mariano Rivera, then the bullpen is just better place for you to go. It's a better way to leverage your skills.
And of course, Rivera did start in as a starter in his first season, and then he moved into the pen.
Well, I have to say his stats have been amazing, guys, and he averaged as a minor leaguer 22 strikeouts per nine innings pitch, which I suppose does suggest that he's got some serious heat and he can beat the bat, which immediately springs, you know, late reliever, closer, etc. But it is an interesting question. How, you know, you've got an arm, you see it's got huge potential. The kid's proved himself at every level that he's played. And why are we assuming that he's going to be a relief pitcher and he's going to be in the bullpen? He's not going to be a starter. Very interesting. And thank you for the Indians UK for that question. I've also got one from Nick Wiseman, guys. Nick Wiseman on Twitter. Nick was replying to us. He said, hey, guys, with the talent available to them, can you lift the hood on the Angels and give your opinion as to what the real issue is there, what fixes they can put in place to turn things around or at least get close to playing 500? They are, of course, having a pretty awful season. And yet you look at the lineup and it's hard to understand why they're not more competitive.
Well, I mean, there are a couple elements on that, Goldie. I mean, first off, Ohtani not being able to pitch is a huge piece of it. Andrew Haney has been disappointing in that rotation. And then you have the whole albatross that is Albert Pujols at this point. I mean, one of the greatest players ever to play, but you're continually rolling him out and he's well past his prime, and that creates a bit of a lag in the lineup. And Justin Upton has also been incredibly disappointing. So there are pieces both in terms of their pitching and their hitting that are underperforming or not even performing in the case of Ohtani when it comes to pitching.
You just imagine the frustration of somebody like Trout. Best player in baseball and
unbelievable
numbers, and yet no one's doing it around him.
Ernie
this
Banks.
Is a good one. This is a good one. Sorry, guys. I know I've not got. Oh, you're kidding me. I've got loads, Eric. You serious?
I know.
Okay, I'm going to be. Guys, keep this quick,
speed
and I
round.
Need one answer. Here we go. Facebook, Dave Harbour. He talks about the hypocrisy of MLB. He says they're willing to accept A-Rod as an owner and a face of a franchise, yet they won't accept him in the Hall of Fame. Now, obviously, that's not quite MLB because that's the baseball writer's decision ultimately. But he's asking, what's your view on the PED players? Obviously, the players that got caught up in the whole drug culture of 20 years ago, that 10, 15 years ago, I should say, that are suffering. The Roger Clemens, the Barry Bonds, none of which have been elected into the Hall of Fame.
I always have believed from day one that you're a product of your era. I think that you weigh that in when you make the determination as to whether a Hall of Famer, but it should not be a bar, and that players like Bonds and Clemens should be in the Hall of Fame. So I think that the discrepancy is on the Hall of Fame side for this.
Dave,
although I don't want A-Rod to be an owner.
When it comes to ownership, I mean, you don't have, you know, it's not as if the history of ownership in MLB has been lily white and, you know, perfectly clean and beautiful. I mean, you know, there's been some cesspool ownerships in the history of Major League Baseball. And, you know, they're just trying to get the highest value that they can possibly. Steve Cohen would bring probably, be the richest person in baseball. But, of course, he's, you know, been brought up on SEC charges. A-Rod has his own ethical issues. One of those two is probably going to get it.
My thing is, if you let Clemens and Bonds and all them in, let P. Rosen as well. Moving on, next mailbag.
And Shoeless Joe. And Shoeless
Can't agree more. And Shoeless Joe, absolutely.
Of course.
Massive thanks to Phil Palmer, David Robson, Roger Whiteside, another chap called Roger, who said absolute nonsense that Tatis has received any criticism at all. They wanted us to talk about the unwritten rules we have, guys. I hope that's helped answer those questions. Here's one very quickly, guys. This is on Facebook. It's Edward Ditchfield, who asked, what future do you see
for baseball. He was very kind about what a difference we made, MLB on 5, getting a whole generation of insomniacs, then talked about the London series now, possibly never to return. What is and should be being done to maintain and grow the sport over here? JC, I think this is probably a question you need to answer.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're all biased, but having baseball on terrestrial television is a huge boon. It's a way for people to happen upon the sport and fall in love with it. In terms of development, I think in certain ways, baseball is on the right track in the UK. I think you have a greater farm system of coaching there than they've had in the past, but they need to figure out a lot of regional disagreements. They need to figure out a lot of governing body disagreements that are occurring, and everyone needs to be rowing in the same direction. And I think that once that happens, that there is hope that we're going to continue to develop players. There are definitely people involved with baseball in the UK who are committed and who know baseball really well. So give them the opportunity to do their job.
Any sport flourishes that's on terrestrial television. Let's face it.
Correct.
You don't stumble upon a sport that you like by subscribing to it, right? So it's got to be shoved in your face. We have a competition winner to announce, do we not, Mr. Johnny Gould?
We certainly do, guys. The question, of course, was to identify the gentleman that was standing with a very young JC. Give us some background to the story of that photograph, JC.
Well, I won't mention the player. I'll let you give that away. But that particular player who turned into a manager, this was, I think it was 9 or 10 years old. So we're looking at like 1980, 1981-ish, somewhere around there. And I mentioned that I played at West LA Little League, which was the inspiration for the Bad News Bears. Before that, I played in a different Little League in Sherman Oaks. And this particular player played there. He came back to look at his old stomping grounds, and I got a chance to snap a pic with him.
Now, this picture was posted on all our social media handles, and thank you to all those who entered the competition and answered who the player was correctly and who the current MLB manager is correctly, and Johnny will take us through it.
Well, quite a few put Don Mattingly, which of course was not the right answer, but that was an awful lot of people actually came up with that on Facebook. Edward Ditchfield, Jim Hudson, Nigel Collier, TJ Waldron. They actually got the right ones, TJ, Kyle McKinley. Bad news for Kyle and TJ, you got it right, but obviously I'm not talking about you being a winner, so you know you haven't won, big guy. We had answers on Instagram as well. D. Robson got it right. Hot Dogs, Beer and Baseball got it right. Given that you're choosing the winner, Eric, I'm amazed you haven't chosen them. Mark Downs got it right. So did Powder Kid 16. We had answers on Twitter as well. Blue Jays Fans UK got it right. I think James Harper, you got it wrong. There's loads and loads and loads. Thank you, everybody, for getting involved. I've given a mention to a few, but there is and can only be one winner. The winner who came out with the right answer, which is, of course, Ron Renneke, is, drumroll, Thomas Briggs.
Woo!
Well done, Thomas. At Thomas Briggs 4.
You should mention
on
what
Twitter.
Team Ron Renneke is a manager for, probably.
The Boston Red Sox. Not there for much go. Longer, though, by the looks of things, JC. Looking at the table. Can you believe how bad Boston are this season?
Oh, I can. Yeah. I can, because they... You know, between the injuries and their pitching staff, and they just traded their two of their best relief pitchers in Embry and Brandon Workman to the Phillies. So they
are. Can I give you hope? Can I give you hope? You're better than Pittsburgh. You're better than the LA Angels, and you're better than Seattle. But only just.
That's not hope, because right now you want to come in last and get the first overall pick. At that point, it's tanking time, perhaps, for the Red Sox.
So thank you.
And you have Chaim Bloom, who I bet is going to be one of the greatest GMs in the history of that franchise. I'm putting all my money on it.
Now, here's the thing. We're also going to be a big plug to Farnham Park. We were saying about keeping British baseball going and alive and flourishing. There will be an event this week if you're in the Slough area in Farnham Park. Go on to the bsuk.com website. Who knows? I might even be there. Who knows? I might even bring this podcast on the road. I don't know yet. We'll see what the weather is like. We'll see what the time is like. Yes, go to Slough. Go to Farnham Park.
What's the event, Eric?
I believe it's the Mets and somebody else playing. The London Mets and somebody.
Where does somebody else come from?
You know what? I should check out bsuk.com and get the information.
Perhaps. Come prepared next week.
Well, next week I'll be there, hopefully. And also, you can find me at the home plate bar and kitchen where Sarah's cooking up burgers and beer. Well, you don't cook beer, you cook mess. Anyways, I will leave it over to Johnny to say our final goodbyes.
Thank you, Eric. And also, I just want to give a quick mention to Manchester Baseball. If you check them out on Twitter, I know they're looking to get new players down. And we've mentioned before, guys, we are here as a British baseball podcast. We want to help wherever we can. So if you want to get in touch, if there's any news you want to get out to the baseball community, then get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. And obviously, huge thanks to everybody that entered the competition. We'll be continuing in that vein on future shows. But that brings this podcast to a close. Episode 6. Huge thanks to JC.
It was great to be here. As always, Goldie, thank you for your steady stewardship of our little podcast.
Needed a quicker response than that, but not to worry. Big Dave.
This is my quick response.
And Eric.
Yeah.
So it's goodbye from them, and it's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening. Look forward to having your company. Same time, same place next week.